opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Thursday, February 26, 2009. We are going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 515, but before we do that, I'm going to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. We have two bills here. I didn't make copies for everyone because one of them is 42 pages long, and I wanted to save some paper. So one of them is relating to garnishment, and one of them is relating to foreclosure, and do we need to summarize those? I don't think so.
You want a motion?
I would like a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the following legislative council drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 2675, dated February 16th, 09; LC 3000, dated February 26th, 09.
And
as committee bills.
Thank you. And Senator George moves that LC 2675 and LC 3000 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I need to make my standard disclaimer that just because I vote to have them introduced doesn't mean I'm going to vote for the bills later.
Thank you, Senator Gerard. The usual caveat that voting for them to be introduced as committee bills does not indicate either support or opposition for the bills.
But it is very important that it has to do with the good senator from Sherwood.
Thank you very much, Senator. So LC 2675 and LC 3000 have been introduced as committee bills. Thank you. And I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 515 and ask our committee administrator to give us a summary of the bill, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 515 has to do with what is commonly known as lemon law provisions. It extends the time period for the consumer to notify a manufacturer of a new vehicle that the vehicle does not conform to warranty. It specifies the reasonable allowance for use calculation. It removes a requirement that the manufacturer be given the opportunity to cure a defect. It allows the consumer to participate in a manufacturer's informal dispute process, makes the decision resulting from that process or settlement binding on the manufacturer but not on the consumer. It allows the award of attorney fees, expert witness fees, and costs to a prevailing consumer. It allows the award of attorney fees to a manufacturer if the court finds that the consumer brought the action in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. It clarifies refundable charges and a procedure for the return of aftermarket items. It requires disclosure of the reason the vehicle was returned to the manufacturer in any future sale or lease or transfer of the vehicle. It makes the lack of that disclosure an unlawful trade practice under ORS 646-608. It defines the term collateral charge, declares emergency, effective on passage.
Thank you very much, Lori, for that thorough explanation. And we have several people signed up to testify about this bill today. I have a speaking engagement in my district this evening, so I'm going to have to end by about 4:40. So if everybody could keep that in mind as you're testifying in this public hearing today. And I also wanted to state before we begin today, some of you may have noticed that this bill has my name on it. And I wanted to make a statement about that. I know that it's a difficult time economically for consumers and also for the automotive industry. I grew up in Michigan. I have family members who have been involved in the automotive industry, and I appreciate that it's a difficult time for everyone in our country economically. That being said, I think that there are important consumer protection issues that need to be addressed, and that's why I brought this bill forward with several co-sponsors, and I look forward to hearing your testimony. And I'm going to try to alternate between proponents and opponents as we go through today. And so I'm going to call first to Danielle, and I hope I say your name right, Beauvoir. I don't speak French. Beauvais. And is Randall Wells with you? Would you like to bring him up with you? Terrific. Thank you so much.
I have a written submission.
Yes, that will go to Anne. Thank you. And if I could ask you and everyone else who's here today to testify, when we get your written testimony, we can read that and we will read that. So if when you're testifying, if you just speak from the heart and summarize your testimony rather than read it into the record, we would all sure appreciate that. So thank you so much.
Okay. Is the microphone on?
Yes, it is. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Danielle Beauvais. I'm a consumer law attorney in Oregon and Washington. Before moving to Oregon, I was practicing lemon law in a firm in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and so I have the benefit of working with lemon laws in four different states. And I can honestly say, after working in four states and reading the lemon laws in all 50 states, that unfortunately the Oregon lemon law, as it is now, is honestly one of the worst in the country, unfortunately. It's a work in progress, and hopefully this bill will help remedy a lot of its defects for consumers. In fact, when I first came to Oregon 3 years ago and I joined the consumer law section of the Oregon State Bar, the most common question that I got from other attorneys is, can you make a living out of this? Because these consumer attorneys had tried and failed. And to this day, I'm the only attorney focusing on lemon law full-time in Oregon to this day. And why? It's not because Oregon has better cars, has less lemons, but it's just that it's very, very difficult to win under the lemon law as it is now. In fact, one of my regular opponents, as his opening statements, always tells arbitrators that it's very difficult to win under the lemon law. Even he says that. Now, the lemon law is intended to be a consumer-oriented remedial statute. It's made to help the consumers. It's supposed to actually alleviate consumers who don't, you know, not the ones who complain about little things, but it's supposed to address substantial defects. Those are the words in the statute. It has to be, you can only win if there's a substantial impairment to the use, the value, or the safety of the vehicle. And so things like funny noises or vibrations, it doesn't work. In fact, well, there's not a lot of case law in Oregon, but in other states there are precedents that state that noises, vibrations, odors are not substantial defect enough to win. Now, for the consumer, of course, having the car smells like smelling like rotten eggs, or having the car shake, that's substantial. But under the lemon law, typically you don't win. So even if the qualifications that are to be introduced in this bill today, even if those are all, they're all passed, still the manufacturers will continue having the benefit of the substantial requirements, which in a sense is the biggest obstacle to meet to win under the lemon law. Defective vehicles are a danger, not only to the driver of the vehicle and the passengers, but to everybody else on the road. And so Oregon has a substantial interest to make sure that a number of lemons are taken off the road. Now, one statistic that I saw is that 1 out of 100 vehicles is a lemon. So that's a lot of vehicles. And the lemon law doesn't even address used vehicles. It only pertains to new vehicles. And the restrictions are so narrow that, like I said before, it's very difficult. So only a small proportion of the lemons can actually be addressed with even the changes that are proposed. We're all aware, like Senator Bonamici explained, we're all aware of the manufacturer's financial conditions due to the economic times. And in fact, last week I had a trial against a motorhome manufacturer who didn't show up, and I found out that just 2 days before they had filed for bankruptcy. So what happens to the consumer then is that you can't even get a default judgment. The case is suspended for 2 years, but if they don't come back in business, then the consumer can't even get the vehicle repaired. So although the manufacturer is having big, problems with the economy, so does the consumer, and it would be really unfair that the defects with the vehicle, the cost of that, are passed onto the consumer. So it would make no sense to design just like it would make no sense to design a statute that would make the manufacturers go bankrupt prematurely, similarly it would make no sense to make the consumer pay for the manufacturer's defects and having to take the responsibility for that. So the statute has to strike a balance between the purpose that is intended and at the same time, to give a chance to manufacturers to address the problem. In fact, the Lemon Law gives a big break to car manufacturers because if you look at any other consumer products, most of the time if you buy a refrigerator or a computer or anything, you can return the product with often no questions asked even. But with cars, you can't do that. If the engine could fail on the way home, you can't return it. Then there's no cooling off period. That's a myth. So what you have to do is file for the Lemon Law. It takes considerable time and everything. So the law really gives a big break to car manufacturers because you have to have a certain number of repair attempts. You have all these requirements that you have to meet before you can win under the Lemon Law. In addition to the substantial impairment requirement of the statute to win, there's a number of other provisions that are not going to change with this bill. For example, cars that have been that were not maintained according to the manufacturer's warranty, you can't win. Or cars that were abused or altered in any way, like today a lot of consumers may add some additives to the gas or may add an automatic starter. All these things void the warranty and you can't use the Lemon Law. So there's some things that will stay in place that protect the manufacturer as well. I mentioned that the Lemon Law applies to, there's no used cars. Used car Lemon Law, it applies to new car only and to new car within a very narrow period. Also, buying a vehicle as is, by the way, there's no remedy at all. So the proposed changes, they concern only a few criteria that the consumer must meet to just get their foot in the door for the Lemon Law. The main criteria, the substantial impairment, is not going to change. So I'm just going to go through the major changes of the Lemon Law very quickly. One of them is the addition of a definition of collateral charge. Without a laundry list of what collateral charges include, then everything is vague and that promotes litigation. So one of the big additions is the finance charges. In many states, finance charges are refunded to the consumer. The reality is that when someone buys a car, the finance charges are aggregated at the beginning of a loan. And so if someone was to get a refund, if you deduct the finance charges, what happens often is that you have a negative number, and so consumers have to pay money to get a refund. So essentially, consumers in some instances can't afford to win. That makes no sense. Also, attorney's fees is a big one. If it's unclear whether attorney's fees will be recovered, then we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know whether the consumer should pay in advance or retain it or whether you wait till litigation. And in fact, attorney's fees are a cost that is a direct consequence of litigation, just like towing charges or rentals. And so they shouldn't have to pay that. If there's too many of such charges, a consumer who gets a replacement as a remedy may have to sell the car to pay the attorney's fees. That makes no sense. Another proposed change is that right now, the way it is, only cars purchased in Oregon can qualify for the Lemon Law. So the proposed change is that it would be purchased in Oregon or purchased out of state but registered in Oregon. That's really important because nowadays, people are very mobile. They switch states for jobs. I've had two cases recently from people in the military, and it was a couple, and they came from the East Coast, and so they bought this SUV to have a reliable vehicle to move the family across the country, and it was a lemon, of course, and all the repairs were done in Oregon, and it's now registered in Oregon, but it doesn't qualify for the lemon law because it was purchased in Florida. So the law would require him to go all the way to Florida for litigation, where all the witnesses are in Oregon. And not only that, but in that state, the car has to be bought and registered in Florida to qualify, but it's not registered in Oregon. So essentially, he can't use lemon law anywhere. That makes no sense. According to the law now, a defect has to be reported within 1 year or 12,000 miles of purchase. We want to change that to 2 years or 24,000 miles. 1 year or 12,000 miles is just too short. Some problems take time to develop. What can start as a simple lit check engine light could turn into engine failure. That takes time. Also, parts take time to arrive. Dealers are booked up. It's just too short of a period. Reasonable allowance for use. That's a deduction that if the consumer is offered a repurchase, there's a deduction for depreciation. It's called a reasonable allowance for use. Right now, there's no formula, and so we have an argument each time you have a case as to how much will be deducted. So I've convinced, because I do this all the time, I was able to convince most manufacturers to use the Washington formula, which, you know, we should have our own in Oregon. Now, there's a question as to whether the mileage, the depreciation should be based on the mileage at the first complaint for the substantial defect or at the mileage at the time of the return of the vehicle. Well, of course, my argument is that it should be at the mileage at the first complaint, like in most states, because it makes no sense to deduct the mileage at the time of the return. This would encourage manufacturers to drag their feet as long as possible, because the more mileage accumulates on the car, the more they can deduct and the less they'll have to pay the consumer. And also, the mileage deduction becomes so high that, once again, they can't afford a refund. They have to pay. So, for example, if you have a car that's returned at 30,000 miles, using the Washington State formula, you multiply by the purchase price, say $30,000, divided by 120,000. That's based on the life prospective life of the vehicle. So that comes to a mileage deduction of $7,500. That's too much because, you know, it actually takes 21 months, save if a car payment is $300 a month. That's low. It would take 21 months to build equity up to $7,500. So if you have 30,000 miles, you lose it all. You don't get a refund. If you have less than that, you actually have to pay to get out of the car. Now, there's a presumption in the lemon law that a vehicle is a lemon if it meets certain criteria. Now, a presumption is something that's taken for granted, but it's not an absolute truth. So, for example, this common sense presumption, like if it's dark outside, it must be nighttime. Well, there's exception. If you have an eclipse, it's dark, but it's not nighttime. So similarly, if a vehicle has been repaired X number of times or has been out of service this many days, it's presumed by law to be a lemon. Well, I don't want the manufacturers to be scared about that because a presumption is rebuttable by contradictory evidence. So for example, even if you have, you know, six repairs for something or 60 days out of service, because the presumption is rebuttable, they can still argue, you know, that there was abuse or that it's not a substantial defect, and so then they can get out of having to purchase the vehicle. So this presumption is not written in stone. It's rebuttable. Another change submitted is that we want to change the 30 business days out of service for 30 calendar days. That's important because a consumer who doesn't have their car for 30 days, well, and they have to rent a car, they don't have to pay per business day, but per actual day. So it should reflect the reality for consumers. The requirements that the manufacturer has had an opportunity to cure a defect is removed, well, that's moot because each repair attempt is an opportunity for the manufacturer to cure the defect because the dealership, they have to go to an authorized dealership. And the way it works today is that these dealerships work very closely with manufacturers, and while the car is under warranty, then they have to, they get paid, actually, they get refunded for the repair by the manufacturer. Here's a really important section. It's important to me, in reality. There's some things that may look innocuous on paper, but in reality it makes a huge difference. And one of those is the Section 5 Alternative Dispute Settlement Procedure. No consumer should be made to go to an alternative dispute resolution. I mean, it sounds great, but they're all different. It says in the statute that if a manufacturer sets one up, then the consumer has to go to it before they can go to court. Well, they're all different. You know, AAA has one, the BBB has one, and there's other ones. And the problem with most of them is that they will hear only Lemon Law claims. But often you have pending claims. You can have maybe something that, I don't know, some CDs that were stolen off the car or whatever. So you can't add those claims. And so essentially you're forced to go to the alternative dispute procedure and then appeal the case. It's a waste of time. You should be able to go somewhere where you can add all your claims together.
And I'm sorry, can I ask you to wrap up because we do want to get to some of the other testimony. I'm sorry.
Sure.
If you could just summarize the remaining points, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. So this one is an important one, and I'll skip to the last one that's really, really important, and it's the statute of limitation. Right now the statute of limitation is 1 year. Consumer has to file within 1 year of the 1 year after they qualified, which is so short. The Lemon Law is close to contract law, and the statute of limitation for contract law is 6 years. So 1 year doesn't make any sense. It's just too short. And people have to get all the documents together, find an attorney, make sure they have the sufficient number of repairs. It's 1 year just makes no sense. So basically, that's it. I'm very grateful to Senator Bonamici for introducing this and for your attention.
Thank you. And if I could ask you real quickly, how does the 2-year, 24,000-mile requirement compare with other states, and how does the statute of limitations compare with other states?
I think I submitted a chart comparing the other states, but basically it's not the best. The change that we're submitting, it wouldn't make Oregon law the best statute in the country. It would put it in a ballpark, essentially. Same
and
with the statute of limitations.
In both of those areas.
Yes.
And we don't seem to have the chart, but we'll see if we can locate it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wells, and then do you want to do questions now?
It didn't matter to me.
Okay.
What do you want to do?
You want to go ahead, Mr. Wells, and then...
Yeah, my name is Randall Wells. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. And my thing would be, I guess, the reasonable use dollars for the use. We bought a Mercedes in Wilsonville in February of 06. At 600 miles, it was taken back and said it had a transmission problem, which they agreed. They tried to use their computer and reprogram it so it would work right. And 1,000 miles, it was taken back, and they completely redid and put in a new transmission, drive lines, and things like that. It still didn't solve the problem. They kept tweaking with it off, you know, we'd take it in, my wife, and they'd work with it while she'd go have coffee. Finally, at 9,000 miles, they agreed that the transmission then that wasn't going to be fixable, and they agreed that they would replace the car, or I could turn this one in and get another one. At that point, the information came back through the sales department that they were going to charge me 75 cents a mile for every mile that I had driven on the car, which was at that point about 10,000 miles, which all of 9,200 miles of that was based on trying to get their parts to make the car work right. And I didn't think that was fair. At the worst, it should have been based on when I first notified the company that there was a problem. After that, I was dealing with a problem, trying to help them solve it. At that point, as a customer, you're lost. What are you going to do? You can either take their 75 cents or keep the car. And the only third alternative I had was try to find an attorney that knew the lemon law, that was willing to go to bat for me against the dealership to a reasonable amount of dollars. And that's what Danielle did. And we finally settled based upon the number of the Washington State law legislatures and their law as to what a reasonable amount of dollars for use was. So at that point, they took the car back, and another one was ordered, and then the financing on that and how to get that was a whole other nightmare. But it was a real dilemma when they had 10,000 miles. I had to pay 75 cents a mile for the use of the car, which I felt was very unreasonable.
If I may add, according
if
to...
If you could say your name, please, before you start.
Danielle Bove. If I may add that according to the lemon law in most states, it would have been a slam dunk. He would have gotten a repurchase or a replacement, but because the Oregon lemon law requires 4 repairs, he couldn't get one, although he had the transmission replaced twice within 9,000 miles.
But they wanted to settle, and yes, and Randall Wells, they wanted to settle or change the car back after 3 because we just wouldn't quite qualify the lemon law, and therefore we wouldn't have as many rights as we would have if we'd have completed the 4th repair.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
Chair.
Senator George.
I appreciate the in-depth analysis, and some things I can definitely see, and other things I'm kind of questioned in so far in your testimony. But one of the very first things you said, Danielle, was one of the things that I'm hypersensitive about. And anybody who serves on committees knows that I'm hypersensitive about one thing. When people bring new regulatory actions before our committees, I have found nowadays that people are bringing regulatory actions forward to enhance their businesses or to gain advantage in the way they run businesses. We see industry bringing regulatory actions to eliminate competitors. So I got to ask you a couple questions if I could. Number one, I'm concerned about the fact that we create a structure where a law firm could, in essence, really specialize in harassing dealers that are already under financial pressure. So I was wondering if you can give me a little bit more about your background as far as like where you worked, and is this the kind of thing you did, and how sophisticated is this process, or is it really consumer-oriented?
This is what I do full-time. I try to help consumers with motor vehicles, not only with lemon law cases, but with fraud or anything to do with cars, motorhomes, motorcycles. But the point is not to try to, you know, to get more business. It's you know, to try to get justice for the consumer. Like I said, it's supposed to be a consumer-oriented statute, and it's not. It really benefits the manufacturer right now. And the consumers are not, these lemons are still on the road. In reality, though, one car manufacturer, I spoke to one of the executives of the company a couple of years ago, and he told me that in reality, it's cheaper for them to have me identify the lemons than for them to implement a way to find those lemons and, you know, to find them all over the state. So in reality, we settled very quickly, and 99% of the cases never go to trial. We get into a routine where we settle everything quickly and cheaply.
follow up if I could?
Yes.
Daniel, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that here, you're fairly new to the state, and I really haven't heard, this case here is very interesting to me because it's actually in my district, and so I find it very interesting and willing to look into it. I guess from, this isn't suspicious towards you. Everybody who comes for me and brings something that's more regulatory has kind of put up with my my hang-up on this, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is it, you mentioned that you practice in other states. I was wondering, like, what kind of law firms did you work for? I mean, are these firms that did exactly the same thing, and the whole firm was built off of basically litigating against dealers?
Not against dealers, against manufacturers. Well, the two firms that I work for, they did focus on lemon law and car cases. The partner who founded the firm where I was the managing attorney, he's a car buff. He loves cars. So that's how he became involved in the lemon law. Why do I do this? Because this is what I know, and I really want to help consumers.
Gotcha.
That's it.
Another question. Here is my... When I look at the bill, it seems to be really broadly drafted in a lot of different areas, and there's clearly some areas where I can find some agreement with some of the things you've said. Mm-hmm. But I look at a situation like what seems to be included, like in RVs. And when I start thinking about RVs, it's not just the transmission like we have it with a car. You're talking about a totally different kind of vehicle. I mean, I guess if like the stove or the bathroom in the back of the RV goes bad, it seems like there's so much more risk. Yes. To manufacturers of more complicated vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that, because to me that seems like a huge drawback to this particular piece of legislation.
Yes, RV cases are very complicated, because with cars, everything is, the parts may come from all over the world, but the manufacturer takes responsibility for the final product, so you sue only one manufacturer. With RV cases, you have so many components in there, and you have to be able to sue the right party. One manufacturer may have done the engine, and another one the transmission, and another one the microwave and the television, and so you have to be able to determine who's the responsible party and not sue others needlessly, because that's a waste. And also, a lot of these motorhome cases don't qualify for the lemon law, because most of the problem I find, people who approach me, they're all cosmetic things. Well, those are not substantial defects. So that it doesn't qualify for the lemon law. So I tell these people, if you have a television problem in your RV, it's aggravating, but that could be like a $1,000 problem. Go to small claims court.
I want to get through some other testimony.
It's
really
interesting. Can I make one point? You said what I said was interesting. I don't know if you've heard of these cases before. But the repurchase of the other car was more of a nightmare, and I'll gladly explain that to your committee sometime, because there should be some provision in the law that also gives the repurchase of an additional car some rights, rather than being that at the total dealer's discretion of what he wants to do.
I really appreciate your testimony. There was one thing that really caught me on this, Danielle, and I'm trying to get at. It's the way that this the bill is drafted says that it is 2 years or 24,000 miles, and it changes from whatever's earlier to whatever's later. And I'm thinking about people I know who live in certain parts of our state that are very spread out. You could have 50,000 miles on a vehicle or 60,000 miles on a vehicle within 2 years really easily in a western state because we drive so far. And it seems like to me that I'm trying to figure out kind of where the liability ends, and when you buy something, you kind of understand that things are going to be broken down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could literally have a car, under the way this is drafted, a car that has 60,000 miles on it going in under a lemon law. Am I reading that correct?
The way I read it is that it's you have to complain within the first 2 years or 24,000 miles, whichever is
later.
comes later.
Mm-hmm. So it could be.
Okay. So there's a limitation of either 2 years or 24,000 miles, not 50,000. Oh, I see. If they put 50,000 miles in 2 years. Well, in practice, you know, manufacturers are not going to offer repurchase if the car has a lot of miles on it, because it's hard to complain of a substantial defect when the problem started at 80,000 miles. Mm. So that substantial defect takes care of everything. And also, the statute is, statutes are always written in a vague way. Why? Because there's so many exceptions. Every case is different. And so the case can't, in practice, you can't look at just, you know, the case with the word, the exact words of the statute. You have to look at the whole picture. And in the end, it's the trier of fact which will decide whether a case warrants a full repurchase.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we'll have Paul Cosgrove, Tom Gallagher, and Craig Campbell, please. You flip a coin to see who's going to go first?
We actually discussed that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So if you don't mind, while they're walking, I'll go ahead.
Go right ahead. Thank
purposes.
You.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. And in my written testimony, it mentions the 11 worldwide manufacturers that are members of the Alliance, and it's most every one of the major car companies in Asia, the United States, and Europe. We oppose the bill for the reason that we think these changes aren't necessary, that they will be burdensome to manufacturers and ultimately costly for consumers. And I won't but just highlight that one of the issues that is important to us is that the industry as a whole and companies individually have spent a great deal of time improving the quality of their vehicles. And the data from third parties like J.D. Power and the R.L. Polk company that's on my testimony reflects that we have addressed this problem primarily through trying to improve quality and have succeeded, not completely, there are always mistakes and problems, but with much better vehicles than we've had, even though those vehicles are much more complex than they used to be. But our major concern about this bill is that we think that it will actually encourage litigation as the method to resolve vehicle defect problems and increase litigation costs, not only harm business, they also don't provide necessarily the best benefit to the consumer. And I'd like to just spend a moment highlighting a couple of the major provisions of the bill of significant concern to us. First, in Section 1, there's a specification of collateral charges, and I think the view that we ought to specify what collateral charges are is a good idea. We have great concerns about some of the collateral charges that are included in the list of specifications, things like aftermarket parts that could have been put on by the consumer significantly after the sale of the car, things like other kinds of insurance, liability insurance that the consumer would have bought on the vehicle, and attorney's fees and costs is another one. Secondly, I have to disagree with your prior witness that, in fact, this Lemon Law always has applied to used cars in certain circumstances. And I'll point to you on line 27 of page 1, the language that does so. This is current law. This is not a change. But it reflects that a car that is transferred to another consumer within the warranty period is covered under Oregon's Lemon Law and always has been. And that's the reason why we are particularly concerned about moving from 1 year and 12,000, whichever is earlier, to 2 years and 24,000, whichever is later. The example given by Senator George is a reality in parts of Oregon, many parts of Oregon, southern Oregon, eastern Oregon, even parts of western Oregon. We drive a lot here. And this means that we could have a car that, in fact, and warranties are getting longer. So if you're talking about within the warranty period and 2 years or 24,000, whichever is later, and it can be the second consumer, this could be considerably after the purchase of the car. So that's a great concern to us. The third issue that I'd like to bring up is the reasonable allowance. This is on page 2 in section 3 at the bottom of the page, subsection 3. This, in fact, provides that even during the period of time between the first complaint and a problem is reportedly solved or hopefully solved and maybe 6 months later will reoccur, all the mileage within that six-month period that the consumers had the benefit of the car between those occurrences would not be counted in terms of the consumer's use, and that's of concern to us. And then the next item is on the next page, page 3, section 5. Mr. Campbell will have some specific data from his client, one of our members and manufacturers, and I am still trying to get data from other clients. But, in fact, there are very few lemon law complaints in Oregon compared to the number of cars sold in this state. And almost all of those are settled with informal mediation, and the few that aren't are settled through the manufacturer's arbitration process that would be essentially gutted with the amendments in this bill. And I did a quick survey of other states' lemons law based on some information we received from your staff, Senator Bonamici, and I'm trying to confirm it with other information, but I think it's nonetheless accurate information. I believe there's only one state, as far as I could do in the quick read, that doesn't require this kind of arbitration process, and I think that the only state that doesn't is New Jersey. And I'll do more careful study. We would be really an outlier in moving our lemon laws out of this manufacturer's arbitration process. It's an important one to encourage resolution early, informally, and cheaply without the cost to either party of court. The last comment I'd like to just make is on the bottom of page 3, there's a significant change in how attorney's fees are awarded in these kinds of cases, and we think that that will, because it unlevels the playing field with respect to attorney's fees, also encourage litigation. I know you're short of time. I would be happy to answer any questions. I will also be happy to try to get some additional information about the arbitration process from some of our other members and provide it to the committee.
Thank you. And I think we'll wait for the whole panel for questions, but just so I don't forget, if you're looking at that, it would be also interesting to find out if the other states have a mandatory arbitration for certain cases like we do in Oregon. Most cases under a certain amount have to go to arbitration.
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you. Go ahead. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I'm not going to go over the bill, so I'll be somewhat brief. Oregon automobile dealers do most of their sales to repeat customers. Customer satisfaction on the retail showroom floor, especially right now, is one of the most important issues that we have. You know, we deal almost on a daily basis with warranty work in our shops. People who have a problem with their car under warranty bring it back into the dealership. The dealership goes into to a lot of time and a lot of effort negotiating with the manufacturers to cover the parts, the labor, et cetera, to get the car back on the road. So that's a big piece of our business. Having a lemon car, having a customer who's dissatisfied with their car, having a customer that goes through a great deal of litigation is something we want to avoid. And we spend a lot of time and a lot of work on that. Sometimes there is a car under warranty that's broken, that can't be fixed and doesn't work. And it's to our advantage to get that car back off the road and get that customer back in a good situation. A number of other times there are unsatisfied customers. There are totally unsatisfied customers that have complaints with the dealership, that have complaints with their car, that don't like what they got, that have an issue. And they pursue that issue as far as they can. That's why we appreciate the arbitration clauses in here. We appreciate the opportunities to sit down with the customer, with the customer's representatives, and try to work these things out. We then work directly with the manufacturer to settle as many of these as we can. It's not to our advantage to have lemon laws, to have people going around saying that they didn't get a good car in Oregon. There are some issues in this bill that we could live with, and we'd be happy to sit down with the plaintiffs or with this committee and figure out which of those pieces would have actually benefit the consumer without so completely tipping the scales for between the customer and the car dealer. Thank you.
Thank you, and I trust that was a slip of the tongue when you said plaintiffs instead of proponents.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's the last time in a few years I've got to use my legal background.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Campbell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of General Motors. To some extent, I'm going to be echoing what my two compatriots have said to you already, so I'll try and keep those parts of my comments brief. Oregon has what has worked for General Motors, a very good lemon law bill, and it's not because it protects us, it's because it puts us in a position where we can work very closely with our customers, because Mr. Gallagher is right. We depend upon repeat customers. If you have a bad experience with a motor company, they're going to tell 10 people. If they're happy, they're going to tell one. So we try to keep the one rather than the 10. We work through situations which are inevitably going to come up where you manufacture a vehicle that turns out to be a lemon. You don't immediately know it. Oftentimes a person will drive off the lot and maybe some time and some effort to discover that it is a lemon. As one of the previous persons providing testimony indicated, you'll go back in for repair two or three times. But ultimately you're going to find out that you have a lemon on your hands. Then it's in our best interest to try and make sure that that customer is taken care of and is happy the way the thing is resolved. There are a couple of specific areas of the bill that we do have concerns about. One, of course, is has been brought up before, and that's Section 5, because it disrupts the process which would otherwise and has otherwise been used to come to an amicable agreement between the manufacturer and the customer. We have had 39 cases in the last year where we had a lemon law situation. In 38 of those, we were able to resolve the situation with the customer without any going to any sort of a formal process. The one remaining one, we actually went to arbitration with him, and that was because we didn't believe there was a lemon law claim, and the arbiter ended up supporting us in that viewpoint. None of them went to court. This would could encourage those customers to go to court first because they don't have to go through any informal process. And that's going to put a burden not only on us as manufacturers, but also on the courts, which are already dealing with a significant caseload and reduced revenues as a result of our current financial situation. The other comment I wanted to talk about is one that has been discussed a couple of times, and I'll add just one other comment to it, and that's Section 8. Not only would you have a situation where you could have a vehicle that could go 60 or 70,000 miles in a two-year period of time, and then they would have 2 years after that period of time to file a suit, you could also have the converse situation where you have somebody who doesn't drive their car very much and could actually extend that period into 4, 5, or 6 years because they haven't met the 24,000 miles requirement under the bill. Those sort of things go well beyond our warranty, and we have concerns about vehicles that have a breakdown that far out and what we need to do about it as a responsible manufacturer. Allow me to finish by making a blanket statement. There are a few items in the bill that we can live with. There are certain sections dealing with a collateral charge, especially those that relate to the purchase or the repair of the vehicle. Those make sense, and we can certainly support those sorts of things. But there are a number of items that are in the bill that, instead of looking like a consumer protection bill, they almost look like they're a manufacturing punishing bill, which I know isn't the intent, but it could certainly come across that way to companies like us who are trying to build a good product and are trying to meet our customers' needs because we depend upon them. And I think with that, I'll end my comments and answer any questions that may come up.
Any questions for this panel? And if we could keep it brief, but there's still several people to testify. Yes.
Madam Chair, I guess the thing that was interesting is that the gentleman who came up and testified who had the problem, and they want to charge him 75 cents, so the consumer use portion of it, and the idea that other states have a schedule on this so it's easily settled, what is the three of yours' perspective on having something more definitive? Because that kind of thing does seem outrageous and improper.
Madam Chair, Senator George, a schedule is fine. The concern we have is about the way this particular schedule is prepared. And in fact, certainty in all of these things are fine, and that's why we could support specification of collateral charges. We just have disagreement about what should be in collateral charges. With respect to this schedule, the specific concern is, in the kind of example I described, a complaint is made, the first repair is made, and then 6 months, because remember that once the first complaint's made, you're within the time period. So you make your first complaint in 2 years. 6 months or a year later is complaint number two. There's a year's worth of use of the vehicle, and under this schedule, we would be paying the consumer. We would not be charging the consumer for that use of the vehicle. We'd just only be charging the consumer as an offset for the time the vehicle was used before the first complaint. And those could be substantial differences, and we don't think that's necessarily fair. Certainly during the period of time it's in our possession, it shouldn't be, you know, anything we put on the vehicle or any time it's away from the consumer, that's a fair charge to put against us. But when the vehicle is at the time it's working, either before the first complaint or after, we think that should be part of the refund.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And next I'm going to ask Keith Dabanovich from the Department of Justice and Emily Kinzer from my office to come up. Emily has been working on this issue, and she has showed me a chart that she worked on to explain the reasonable allowance for the consumer's use, and so I asked her to come here and explain it to the committee as well. So, Keith, do you want to go first and then Emily?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich, and I am special counsel for Attorney General John Kroger. Thank you for the opportunity to come today. While the Department of Justice does not have enforcement authority over lemon law issues, in our capacity as one of the state's key consumer organizations, we do receive a number of lemon law complaints, and we do our best to resolve those. Based upon our analysis and having looked at other states' laws, it is our opinion that our lemon law at the present time is one of the weakest in the country. We thus support the amendments to SB 515. What I'd like to do is address briefly what we do when we receive a consumer lemon law complaint, and then address one key provision of Senate Bill 515. As the members of the committee know, we receive inquiries by phone and written complaints. We tabulate these so that we can keep track of what's going on in both the industry and also what kind of complaints we're receiving. And our personnel codes something in our database as a lemon law complaint if the person alleges that they brought their car to a dealership three times for repairs on the same problem and it's still not fixed, if the person alleges that the title was branded in another state as a lemon, or if they allege that it's a lemon and they provide an indication that it somehow fits within our lemon law. In 2007, we received 19 written lemon law complaints, and this past year we received 16. Now, when we receive a written consumer complaint, we generally forward it to the dealership or the manufacturer, and we encourage the parties to work together toward a resolution. And frequently, that's resolved at that point. I'd like to give you a couple of examples of complaints that we've received. One consumer brought their Jeep in five times to a dealer for repairs because it leaked water on both the passenger and driver's side when it rained. And having lived in Oregon a number of years, it tends to rain here in Oregon, and that's quite a problem. Another consumer complained that their car had a steering problem since the date of the purchase, and they brought their car to a dealer for repairs 10 times. And another consumer started corresponding with a manufacturer 10 months after purchase of a motorhome. The motorhome had a lot of problems, including the fact that the engine was misfiring and the windshield wipers were not working. These are the kind of problems that need to be resolved, or else they indeed become inoperable motor vehicles and are not safe on our highways. One of the key reasons that the Department of Justice supports Senate Bill 515 is because the amendments strengthen our existing lemon law in a number of key ways, and I'd like to focus on one, and that is requiring that the title be branded as a lemon law buyback if the purchases, if the vehicle is repurchased, and that any subsequent purchaser be notified that indeed the title is so disclosed. As anyone has ever bought a car and financed it knows, you don't actually get the title. It ends up going to the finance company. So unless the retailer or dealer properly discloses that the title has been branded as a lemon law buyback, the purchaser might never know that indeed it's a lemon law buyback until years later after they've paid off the lien and have actually gotten the physical title. So that provision is extremely important. And to make sure that that provision is properly enforced, SB 515 gives the Department of Justice authority under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to pursue civil fines if someone fails to properly label the title and disclose the existence of that branding as required by this law. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Go ahead.
Keith, I guess when I look at this bill, it's I mean, all of us appreciate maybe changing some lemon law things, and I think we acknowledge there's some differences. But this bill right here goes pretty far one direction. So is the DOJ supporting the bill as drafted or simply saying that there are some changes that need to be made, you'd support them? So do you support the bill as drafted right now?
Chair Bonamici, Senator George, I'm here speaking in general about the bill. Certainly, we don't have any opposition to it being refined if it can be improved upon. This is the first time, obviously, that I've heard that there are some concerns about the bill. I'm here primarily to emphasize the necessity of branding the title, because that is a critical component so that a subsequent purchaser of a vehicle will know that there's a problem with that vehicle.
Thank you.
Senator
Drake. Thank you, Chair. To follow up on what Senator George was saying, there was some testimony on numerous things that they had problems with, and one real always hits home with me, and it's doing away with binding arbitration. Do you have a problem with binding arbitration at the Justice Department?
Chair Bonamici, Senator DeGraud, we certainly don't have any opposition to binding arbitration. Indeed, I think, as Senator Bonamici pointed out, in Oregon, a claim, unless you're buying an expensive Mercedes or a Maserati, most claims involving automobiles are going to go to arbitration in the state, whether you like it or not, because of the way our court system is set up. And so whether you have a binding arbitration by contract or it's going to arbitration because of the court system, it really doesn't matter in the state. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be true in a lot of other states. Texas, New York, Florida, Pennsylvania may not require arbitration, but because of the value of most automobile purchases and thus the dispute being regarding that purchase, it's going to go to arbitration in this state regardless of whether you have it in a contract or not.
Totally different issue. We're wanting to change the number of miles from 12,000 to 24,000. That seems pretty excessive to me as well. Would you care to talk about that?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Garrard, it's an interesting conundrum that you face. I can conceive of someone that doesn't drive their car very often, and they drive it only on a sunny Sunday, which is obviously quite rare in Oregon. But I think it would be quite fair for them to expect that that automobile would last reasonably well for 2 years or 24,000 miles. I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation. On the other side of the coin, as Senator George pointed out, I certainly understand the difficulty if somebody is driving 50,000 miles a year, that they would be entitled to arguably 100,000 miles before they would need to raise a complaint. So I don't know the proper solution to this, but I can conceive of circumstances in both directions where you would need the 2 years or 24,000, and that seems like a reasonable number.
And I do believe, Senator, that that's we looked at many other states before deciding on that. We didn't pull it out of thin air, I assure you. Emily, any other questions for Keith? Emily.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Kinser. I serve as a legislative assistant to Suzanne Bonamici, Senate District 17. I'm here today to provide a little bit of clarity around Section 3, Subsection 3 of the bill, which you'll find on page 3, starting on line 22. As mentioned by Danielle Beauvais, Oregon currently has no defined formula for calculating the deduction from the amount to which the consumer is entitled as a refund or exchange amount, also known as the reasonable allowance for use. I did put together the chart you see in front of you, the reasonable allowance for use chart, in order to get a better understanding for where the proposed formula would put us in a range of the other 50 states. The chart includes every state except California, Florida, and Tennessee. That information was not available to me at the time. We also have another handout here where I put together two examples of what would happen in various states. I'd like to direct your attention to example number one, where a consumer purchased a car for $25,000 and then drove it 20,000 miles before noticing the defect, which would be possible, obviously, under Senate Bill 17 changes. And as you can see, Oregon's proposed formula, where the cash price is multiplied by the mileage driven at the time of the first defect and divided by $120,000, which would result in a deduction from that $25,000 of $4,167.67. You can see where the other, on your chart, you can see where the other states would place the same situation. We believe that the approach taken by Senate Bill 515 is a moderate approach that is fair to both the manufacturer and dealer and the consumer.
There's another example on the other side. Emily,
there is another example on the other side in which the consumer drives 10,000 miles. I just wanted to provide a little bit of difference. You can see that the different formulas do result in slightly different amounts based on the mileage that a consumer drives. For example, and Maryland, as one example, does not change at all, which seemed a little bit rigid. It seemed like the mileage should be taken into account for the benefit of both sides.
And Emily, what would happen in your home state?
In my home state of New York, if the consumer had only driven 10,000 miles, there would be no deduction at all, whereas if the consumer had driven 20,000 miles, there would be a deduction of $2,000.
Thank you. Any questions for Emily?
No, Chair. I just want to thank you for doing that. Actually, those examples are very helpful, so I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I thought
so, too. That's why I invited her. Any questions, Senator Dodd?
Nope. Looks good.
Thank you very much. Next, I'll have John Brenneman and Shannon Nill. I hope I got that right.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Senators. My name is Shannon Nill. I'm a car dealer. I own Guarantee Chevrolet in Junction City, Oregon. And my father owns Guarantee RV Center, which we operate on the same property. And I'm also president of the Oregon RV Dealers Association, so I'm representing all three groups. We are opposed to Senate Bill 515. We feel the current lemon law standard in Oregon is very thorough and normally results in a repair by the manufacturer or the dealership before the need to execute the lemon law buyback. At our dealership, in the 20 years I've been at Guarantee, we've only had a small handful of buybacks that resulted due to the fact we couldn't repair the vehicle in the first place. But also, let me talk about the RV industry for a minute. The RV industry is a rising star in Oregon for manufacturing jobs. We build value-added products, bringing in money from outside the state of Oregon. We don't use outsourcing, and we don't have foreign competition. It's a very strong value to Oregon and the United States. The timing of this House bill is very poor, given the state of the economy and the difficulty the manufacturers, the domestic car industry, as well as the RV industry, is having right now. Big-ticket items cannot be treated like appliances or pizzas on money-back guarantees. Once a vehicle is used, it remains used and cannot be returned to a new state. Therefore, the components can be replaced, the engine can be replaced, transmission, whatever problem the vehicle has, but I personally don't believe in lemons. I believe the vehicles are made by humans that are infallible, can make mistakes, but all those parts can be replaced or repaired. General Motors, who we represent, has a very strong warranty coverage on all vehicles, 100,000 miles. There's no deductible on the warranty. General Motors provides free rentals if the vehicles are in overnight, and you can't ask for a lot more. The other domestic manufacturers and most of the imports are quite strong as well. There's also no as-is conditions on new vehicle sales in Oregon, as was mentioned earlier. We suggest an overhaul of Senate Bill 515 or outright elimination. Oregon's lemon law is already particularly burdensome on motorhome manufacturers because, unlike most states, the law covers the entire motorhome. A motorhome is a house on wheels. It's subjected to earthquakes every time it's driven across our roads, which are in deteriorated shape. The car business in the state of Oregon represents thousands and thousands of jobs. If we continue to put a squeeze on the manufacturers, the entire domestic car industry is subject to going away completely, where we would only be able to import cars in America. And even the import companies are having trouble. Even Toyota's announced recently they're making major job cuts and finding quite a bit of trouble in their business as well. Speaking for the RV dealers in the state of Oregon, who are all behind what I mentioned today. We do feel this House bill is ill-timed. It's very onerous on the manufacturers and our dealership and the other dealerships that we work with in the Oregon RV Dealers Association feel we need to go easy on the manufacturers if they're to stay in business at all. Now, Monaco is a good example. They're our neighbor of ours, our number one manufacturer. They're currently on furlough right now, working on getting open back up. Over 2,000 jobs are at stake, that company alone. Country Coach is right next door to us. There's another 700 employees at stake with that company. Matters like this could easily tip those companies from leaving the state or going out of business altogether. And the RV industry is a good industry for America, building products that are used in America and very popular and family-oriented. And Oregon is one of the best states to use RVs. We have more RV parks and private hands as well as state parks. We just opened up a brand new RV park in Eugene at Armitage Park. It's actually a county park, 32 spaces. Another new RV park just opened up in Harrisburg called Riverbend RV Park with 110 spaces. This is a big part of our economy, and this House bill threatens that very industry and our company, frankly. We do feel this bill needs to either be carefully overhauled or, as I said earlier, eliminate altogether. So that concludes
my
remarks.
Thank you for your testimony. Tom?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Consumer Protection Public Affairs Committee. My name is John Brenneman. I'm an Oregon contract lobbyist. My client is Recreational Vehicle Industry Association, RVIA, represents a trade association of RV manufacturers. Before you have testimony of five pages that was faxed in earlier today by Craig Kirby, who is Vice President and General Counsel. RVIA is headquartered in Reston, Virginia. Approximately 98% of the RVs that are produced in the United States are members of RVIA. Some of the things that Shannon mentioned is that Oregon has a large presence of manufacturers, and there are small businesses that are on the brink of survival or not. And in November of 2008, over 55% of the RV workforce across the nation was out of work, and that's only gone higher. And RVIA believes that the burdens imposed in Senate Bill 515, and it also applies to motorhomes, can be the kind of burdensome situation that further can devastate the employee workforce in Oregon. Oregon's lemon law already is particularly burdensome because it covers the entire motorhome, not only the chassis, which that one half of the states only include the chassis. This law in Oregon covers the microwave, the TV, the range, anything that's inside there in the living quarters. And so it's pretty broad. You can hit the threshold of a lemon in Oregon at a much earlier stage. The lemon law period that's been talked about, 12 to 24,000 miles, and then the 1 to 2 years, whichever occurs later. Motorhomes quite often are driven from 3,000 to 6,000 miles a year, and the average being 4,500 miles. So you could have an extension on a motorhome from 6 to 8 years period in which this would be covered. A lot of things have been covered. I'm trying not to give you too much of the five pages, but try to hit some of the major points. It's not uncommon, you know, for a consumer to drop off a motorhome at Mr. Neal's dealership and leave it and say, fix it when you have time. I won't be needing it for a while. And they're just not a kind of situation that's used on a daily basis. And so these days at the dealership count toward the
days out of service, and that trigger then can be particularly burdensome on a motorhome. Sometimes when somebody's out traveling and they encounter a problem, they'll go into a dealership and talk about it. A part might be ordered but forwarded to another dealership for repair down the road. When that happens, that would count then as two visits rather than the one. Let me go to what happened with one of the first times I represented the manufacturers was about 12 years ago when the Oregon Automobile Dealers brought in a bill for dealers' rights, and it also extended to dealers' rights for Mr. Neal's organization. We came into the legislature, both the dealers and the manufacturers, and asked to be dealt out of that dealers' rights bill and promised to sit down with the dealers' organization in the interim and produce a dealers' rights specific to our industry, and we did that. We have been negotiating further on that over the last few years. This is one of the first sessions in a while where we haven't come back to do a minor cleanup or change in that agreement between the dealers and the manufacturers. Right now, there's a similar work group that is occurring between RVA and the International Association of Lemon Law Administrators. It's called IALLA. It's a nonprofit organization created by state lemon law administrators. They've been negotiating a lemon law national bill that covers motorhomes, and we are at this stage about 99% completed. Mr. Kirby will forward some information on the latest draft and where we are, and we would ask that in this regard of Senate Bill 515 that the motorhome industry be taken out of this bill at this point. We'll come back next session, and Oregon could be one of the first states in the nation to adopt that national platform. In the case that we continue, on the last page you'll see there are six recommendations for change. And, of course, one of them, I just mentioned how we can have the lemon law applied to us for as long as 6 or 8 years because of the 12,000-mile provision, whichever is the whichever one drags out the longest, and we say, you know, change that to whichever occurs first. There are five other recommendations that you can read there that we suggest. I would like to continue to work with the chair, Emily, and see if we can develop something here that we could go along with. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I want to assure both of you that it certainly isn't anyone's intent to do anything that's going to put anybody out of business in these economic times. And I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate the suggestions for places where we could talk further about these issues. Are there any questions? We still have a couple more witnesses. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm sort of surprised that RVs are covered. They're such a dramatically different kind of vehicle. With dramatically different use. I mean, it's like you're regulating two completely different types of vehicles. They're almost two totally different products. How did it become that in Oregon's law we regulate RVs and automobiles in the same lemon law? And then how is it that RVs are regulated beyond their chassis in the Oregon lemon law? Why has that been able to be? Is there some history to that and why that decision was made?
Yes, Senator George, I believe that was because the motor vehicles were, because it was a motor vehicle, they were lumped in with cars, and they're a totally different animal. They're a house on wheels, and some of them are up to 45 feet long. So it's not fair, even in the present lemon law, to cover the warranty on the interior when those are components that could easily be replaced. But I'm not sure exactly how that transpired, but I do know, being that they're motor vehicles, they were lumped in with cars.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd say that it seems like you're regulating two different things with the same set of regulations, so I'd be an advocate for separating you guys out. So.
Well, that's a good idea. Thank you.
Well, we'll take that suggestion under advisement.
It just shocks me.
Senator George.
Let's regulate apples and oranges in the same. So
we still have three more witnesses. We have Matt Wallace.
Thanks, Senator. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Wallace, Angela Martin, and Sybil Hebb, please.
Go first, I guess.
Sure.
Matt?
We'll go in the order in which we were called.
For the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm a consumer advocate for OSPERG, statewide citizens-based public interest advocacy group. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak before you today on this issue. I'll keep my verbal comments really short. I just wanted to add our support for updating Oregon's lemon law to match and more evenly protect consumers as the laws in many other states already do, including our neighbors in Washington and Idaho and California. Specifically, though, there's just one additional reason why I think it is important that we look at protecting consumers from defective automobiles in the current economic climate, and I think that is, as the economy gets worse and fewer people are buying new cars, anything that we can do at the state level to increase consumer confidence that they will have a car that can be reliable and they will have options to make sure that the purchase that they're making, a pretty big investment for most people, is something that they will be able to have confidence that's a wise and safe decision. And I think that an update to Oregon's lemon law achieves that purpose very well in making sure consumers know that they have the ability to, have defective automobiles properly taken care of by the dealer and the manufacturer. So including the testimony in the last paragraph, there are a couple of consumer tips that we have, even if the new law would be passed, that we think are pretty applicable for most consumers, and you can read those at your leisure. But I'll actually leave my verbal comments to that for now.
Thank you, Matt. Sybil?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, here today in support of Senate Bill 515. I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify about this bill. As you know, the Oregon Law Center represents low-income people across Oregon. For our clients, the value of a car may surpass the value for many others. Often it's the most important, most valuable thing that they own. It's their link to jobs, to school, to health care, to caring for their children. It's really a lifeline, especially for our clients who live in rural areas where there is no public transportation. And so, where a car goes wrong, where a car is a lemon, it can have a substantial impact on a client's or on our family's abilities to continue about the necessities of their lives. And we often find that, unfortunately, where there are lemons popping up in families, we think that it helps to contribute trapping them in poverty. You're not able to get to your job interview. You're not able to get to your workplace because you're 30 miles away and there's no public transportation and you can't find a ride. And that's a significant impact. And so having some opportunity to redress that, some greater opportunity than is currently provided under the law, we think will really help our clients. We don't actually practice in this area of the law. We're unable to assist all of the eligible clients because we have a lack of resources, but we do see this as a significant request for assistance because we see just numbers of clients coming in after having been repeatedly at the car shop, unable to resolve the problem with the substantial investment that they've made, often with the help of family and friends and neighbors. I mean, lots of times we're really talking about people who are pulling resources together so that they can have a car in the first place. So very much appreciate the bill's proposal, and I thought I would say, specifically, really appreciate the recognition that calendar days instead of 30 business days is an important aspect, especially where you're talking about a disruption in a person's ability to go about his or her life, and appreciate the fact that only three instances of a substantial, repeated, same substantial problem would be required instead of four. So very much appreciate those, as well as the other aspects that have been outlined in previous testimony, but maybe most primarily the collateral damages provisions. We're talking about trying to make people whole for the losses that they've suffered. If financing charges are not able to be refunded to clients who have put forward these resources, they're unable to go and get another car very often, and so that's an important aspect of the bill's proposals. And specifically also appreciate the attorney's fees provisions. Like I said, we're not able to take these cases. There are very few places that are accessible to low-income clients, and reversing the challenge there with the attorney's fees really helps to make access to justice more accessible. So appreciate that, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Angela.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Interesting, as I did some research for this, as we've already heard, every state has a lemon law. An interesting component of this is how many states are actually updating their lemon laws this session. As a matter of fact, Portland, Maine was the first one that popped up. Similar to the proposal in Section 10, voiced a strong concern about the labeling of lemon buyback, and looking at similar proposals there to protect their consumers. The thing that they noted is an increase in the number of cars that were moving across state lines. Georgia has already beat us to this, and they just updated their lemon law, similar to the provisions that are in this proposal for the time and mileage. Georgia updated their law to reflect a two-year, 24,000-mile protection period from what was previously a one-year, 12,000-mile protection period. In that movement, they reflected that it was an important move at this time in our recession for small businesses. Similar to the comments that Matt made, that we need to restore consumer confidence. And the ability to invest in a small fleet of vehicles right now is something that we need to assure small business owners that they can do so without taking on the added risk of thousands of dollars in repair or replacement costs. I want to specifically voice our support for the key provisions being, again, the change in time period, clarifying the reasonable allowance, the provision that would brand vehicles as the lemon buyback cars, enforcement of the lemon buyback entitlement through Department of Justice. And then I'm going to speak to Section 6, the attorney fees provision. Really, the structure and rules that guide enforcement of the law are as important as the substantive policy of the law. Under the current construction of Oregon's lemon law, the risk that a consumer seeking redress before a judge may be liable for paying attorney fees for both sides actually serves as a deterrent to effective enforcement of our consumer protection laws. The proposal in Senate Bill 515, which would allow prevailing plaintiff attorney fees, would make the penalty an effective deterrent to breaking the law instead of the enforcement being an effective deterrent to actually going and seeking justice for that consumer. The proposal, as we've heard, protects manufacturers from frivolous lawsuits by making consumers liable for the manufacturer's attorney fees in cases where it was brought in bad faith. All told, we support Senate Bill 515 and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Angela. Any questions for this panel?
I'm Chair.
Senator George.
Thanks. In looking at this bill, in my district, I cannot think of any time I've been contacted about a lemon law problem. And I can't think of any constituents I've had, any town hall that I've had. And so I'm always a little bit leery of bills that seem to be bills in search of problems, or maybe attorneys in search of employment situations. The case that was brought up here at the very beginning was very interesting to me, because I clearly could identify the problem in the lemon law bill. The person's problem was actually fixed in the current lemon law bill. If it just took him litigation, that seems inappropriate. So I'm trying to figure out if this is a problem that is really something that our constituents are
having problems with the current law. And I guess what would be helpful for me is any time we had testimony from the GM representative here that they've basically dealt with all 39 of their situations outside of the courts. So it would be really helpful if I actually had real consumers to get an idea of any problems, because literally this is a problem I have not even heard of being a problem since I've been in office, and I would look for real people who have real problems who have not been dealt with or addressed in the current lemon law. And I think the only thing I've been so far convinced of is this idea of fixing this issue of what the charge is for use. So it's not much question. It's kind of an assignment that I would, that before I could go there, I really need consumers who really actually have problems that aren't fixed through the current arbitration process.
Thank you, Senator. And we can ask the various groups and agencies, whether it be the Attorney General's Office or Department of Consumer and Business Services, Better Business Bureau, or anyone to whom a consumer would make a call about this issue. And I think Danielle might have some information about that as well. Any other questions for this panel? Senator Gerard? Senator Burdick? Thank you very much for your testimony. This is our first public hearing on this bill, and we have a lot of information that we've gathered today. It's my intention to get together with some of the groups and talk about where we can make some changes. I know that there are issues that were identified that should be addressed, and I welcome your participation as long as we don't have a quorum committee. anyone's interested in helping with that issue, I would appreciate it, and I'll ask Emily to get in contact if you are here and you're interested in a short work group on this issue to try to identify some of the key issues where we can go forward. Please let Emily know, and we'll be getting together and seeing what we can do about this. And I want to thank everyone for your attention today. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515, and we are adjourned.